Prime time is anytime. Subscribe to the Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Hour number three of Primetime Sports is Canada's most listened to sports talk show on the Sportsnet family of networks. Bob McCowan, Damian Cox in our Toronto studios. Mix things up this hour. Three guests. I suspect three slightly different topics, if not completely different topics. Don Banks will join us later. Packers-Bears in the Thursday nighter. And it could be an Alphonse and Gaston game because the Packers are playing crummy and the Bears are crummy. So you could have two losses. This game. You take it. I don't want it. We'll get to that with Banks a little bit later on. Also, Richard Deitch, and you never know what you're going to get with him. So it could be all over the map. We could talk broadcasting. We could talk TV ratings.
I'm sure he'll have thoughts on the debate last night. I'm sure he has thoughts on everything.
In the midst of my insomnia last night, I flipped on CNN.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they had endless panels discussing the relative merits of the debate and the political situation in America, and without dwelling on it, the one thing that I guess I've noticed before, but just didn't put into my brain was, you know, they'll have a couple of media guys on the panel who are supposed to be neutral, who invariably hate Trump, and so they're pro Clinton. You know, they'll have a couple of Democrats on the board who will say everything positive about Clinton. And then they'll also have two Republicans on the board who will sit there and try and defend Trump. The interesting thing is,
they are surrogates. They are there to spout the Trump line no matter what.
But the two Trump guys, the two Republicans, on and on and on, could not answer questions that were given to them about Trump's performance.
They kept wanting to talk about Al Gore.
Oh, yeah, exactly. They want to talk about Al Gore and losing to Florida by 500-some-odd votes. Then they want to talk about Clinton and the emails still.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
I mean, they just won't be on topic. Anyway, that'll be over soon.
It's sort of like this show. Rarely on topic.
Well, we hope it's a little more entertaining than that. I mean, every time I flip on CNN and watch this nonsense about the U.S. election, it's the same stuff over and over and over again. It is interesting, though, other than on Fox. It's like nobody in the media is pro-Trump.
And
nobody.
And every day he...
Other than Fox.
He's lost all three debates and badly. And he somehow manages to find a couple of quasi-media outlets who will say that he won it. And then he immediately tweets it out. Even Fox doesn't. It's always like today it was the Washington Times and something else. Like, you got to dig to find these. And he's got this crazy... campaign chairman. It's a show, man. And now he's saying he may not accept the results of the election.
No. Yeah. Well, he said he wouldn't accept the results. He says they're fixed.
No, actually,
rigged.
Today what he rigged. Said was, I will accept them if I win.
If I win. All right. Is Danny with us yet? No, we're still waiting for Shulman. Shulman's doing some TV work, getting prep for tonight's game. He's working the Cubs and the Dodgers, right?
So I still feel, and I said this after the win over Texas, I thought they should go to the World Series. They didn't. I think this is a massive disappointment for the Toronto Blue Jays. I think this is it's similar, not the same, similar to in the early 90s when the Maple Leafs went 7 with the LA Kings, got knocked out, and everybody went, okay, next year. And then they went out to the conference final four again and got beat in 5, I think, by Vancouver. You assume it's going to be a steady progression up, but this feels more like a setback than last year.
See, I don't think that, and I'll tell you why, because all year long I had concerns about this offense, that it wasn't the same offense as last year, and not just that they didn't hang up double-digit numbers on any kind of regular basis, which they did in 15. It's just I didn't – too many games where they were befuddled by pitchers that didn't befuddle anybody else.
And I'll give you that, but the starting pitching in particular was so much better than last year.
Oh, my God.
That you thought, well, even if they don't hit.
But that's just it, though, Damian. Like, if they scored three runs a game, they're back in Cleveland with the lead. Technically, they may very well have won the series already.
And that's the funny thing, and I'm sure Dan, when he joins us, will have a thought on this. But
Danny's with us now.
You can say, oh, you want to be more like Cleveland. Well, hang on a second here. They had 25 hits. I think they hit below 200.
They did.
In the series, but they did. Their hits came at the right times and certain types of things. So anyways,
Dan Shulman of Sportsnet and ESPN joins us now from Los Angeles, California, where the Dodgers and the Cubs will go to a pivotal Game 5 tonight at Chavez Ravine. Hello, Danny boy.
Hi, fellas. How are you?
I know you've been focused on the National League because that's what you've been covering, but I assume you've had one eye on the Blue Jays and the Indians.
Absolutely. And, I think I just heard the tail end of what you guys were saying before you brought me on it, and I think the Indians did the little things better. You know, they were a little better here, a little better there. But more than anything, I think they had a smart game plan against Blue Jays hitters. I mean, I think they threw a lot of soft stuff. I think they kept the ball away from the Blue Jays right-handed batters.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of the Blue Jays right-handed hitters are what they are. They're power hitters. They're pull hitters. They're not guys who make adjustments as often as most other guys. And I think that's why we saw kind of the feast or famine nature of this team this year. You know, I think there's a lot of hits out there to right and right center field for those right-handed batters, but, you know, they get paid to hit the ball over the fence. And most of the time when you hit the ball over the fence, you pull it. So, I'd love to see a breakdown of how many pitches the Indians threw over the inner half of the plate or the outer half of the plate. It sure felt to me like it was about 10 times as many.
I agree.
Outside part of the plate. And I think they had a really smart game plan. I think they scouted the Blue Jays extremely well. And I think their pitchers executed extremely well.
Well, I think that's the point. I mean, I don't think there's any great surprise that you want to throw breaking balls when you can away from the Blue Jay right-handed hitters, or backdoor them if you're a left-handed pitcher, keeping it on the outside plate. What I thought was remarkable was their ability to hit their spots. I mean, they didn't miss. They didn't miss very often on that outside corner.
No, you're right. It's as well as and you're right. The game plan is part and executing it is part, and both were A+, I think.
You bet.
On the part of the Indians. And I think, by the same token, you can look at the Blue Jays and say, you know, to some of the guys, hey, you got to adjust a little bit better. You should try to make adjustments a little bit more. But again, that's not the nature of the beast for this team all that often. But I thought they executed beautifully. You know, what Ryan Merritt did yesterday, for a kid making his second major league start, not a big draft pick, not a hard thrower. You know, the fact that he didn't appear to be nervous, although he may have been on the inside, but from the first batter on, he was, you know, on the outside corner, then fastball in to move them off the plate, then change up away, curveball down, whatever the case may be, he hit his spots. And they deserve a ton of credit. You know, there's obviously in Toronto and across Canada, the focus is on what the Blue Jays did or didn't do. But I think it's what the Indians did that was the most important reason they won the series.
Well, and let me ask you about this. I'm taking great risk at asking you this because Bob is sitting here, and I know what Bob thinks, and he's going to jump all over this. But I'll ask you in such a way that I'm going to try to keep Bob at bay for a minute. There are more than a few people in Toronto who think that Terry Francona had a decisive edge over John Gibbons in this series. Do you agree?
Well, I think Terry, and I say this every time I'm asked about him, full disclosure, he's a good friend of mine. We used to work together at ESPN. I think he's one of the best managers in baseball, and maybe the best manager in baseball. When you combine the strategy and the human touch that he's got, he doesn't speak the King's English, and he's the first one to admit that, but he is a great, great baseball manager. But I don't think that John Gibbons did anything wrong. I think Terry Francona did a lot of things right. I mean, the way he manipulated his bullpen in the game in which Trevor Bauer came out in the first inning, you know, using spotting guys in for 20 to 30 pitches so they'd all be available the next day, bringing Andrew Miller in different spots in different games at what he felt was the most important moment of the game. I think Terry did a lot of things right. I'm not sure what John Gibbons did wrong. I mean, they got 8 runs in 5 games.
But it sounds like you are saying you think that Francona did give them an edge.
But the difference is, one of the differences is, Damian, is managing with a 3-1 lead or a 2-0 lead is a lot different than managing with a 2-0
Absolutely.
Deficit.
Yeah,
you know, and
I agree.
And you know, the American League has, believe me, I've been watching nothing but craziness on the National League side between the Cubs and Giants, and now the Cubs and Dodgers. My scorecard, it looks like a, you know, looks like graffiti at the end of the night with all the moves these managers are making. The American League is a much, much different game, and there isn't as much room to make moves. But you know, for the Blue Jays to win that series, they had to get the lead. They had to take Miller, Shaw, and Allen, especially Miller, out of the equation, and they didn't do that. Mm-hmm. So I don't lay any of this at the feet of John Gibbons. I think Terry Francona did a great job with the resources that he has, and I think the Blue Jay hitters didn't get the Blue Jays leads, and that's why they lost.
And you know, and I, not to belabor the point, the one manager doesn't have to do things wrong for the other manager to give his team the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, it does not. You do not have to be critical of John Gibbons to say Terry Francona's managing gave them an edge to win this series.
Look, but what did Frank? I don't want to get into this debate.
Look at their rotation.
I don't want to get into this debate. And Francona is one of my favorite guys. Yeah. I'd love to have him managing the Toronto Blue Jays if you didn't have John Gibbons, and he'd probably be the number one guy on my list. So I got nothing bad to say about him. Having said that, all he can do is push the buttons. The guy's got to go out there and perform.
Absolutely. Of course.
He had his pitcher go down after 2/3 of an inning with the finger thing. And now what is he going to do? Well, he's going to use his whole bullpen, and he's going to use him about an inning or a little bit more than an inning.
He could have done a number of different things. He chose to do that.
Well, he did, and it worked out. I mean, does that make him clairvoyant? I don't think so.
No, I mean, he made one move that didn't work out, and that was walking Donaldson to get to Encarnacion.
That's right.
To get a two-run single. Mm-hmm. And you know, the thing is, you could make the right move and it turns out wrong. You can make the wrong move and it turns out right.
That's it.
And the vast majority of moves are in the center. They're gray area where I understand what you're doing. You could look at it another way. The numbers say this. My hunch says that. And I think that's what Tito does best. You know, 95% of the moves made by managers, especially American managers, are all going to be the same. But I think what separates Terry Francona from just about every other manager in the game, not everyone, but just about everyone, is his feel for people. Is, you know, he could have buried Trevor Bauer for playing with a drone and getting his finger chewed up.
Should have, probably.
Yeah, he probably should have, but he didn't bury him because he's not like, I know him really well, and I know how I've heard his players talk about him. I talked to Dave Roberts today, who's the manager of the Dodgers, who played for Terry Francona when they won the World Series in 2004. It was Dave Roberts that stole that key base in the ninth inning of Game 4 against the Yankees, and that started the whole comeback. He loves Tito. Everybody who has ever played for Terry Francona loves him because he makes the 25th guy on the roster feel like the most important guy on the roster. And I just think he's got a really good way of taking the pulse of his players on the team. He doesn't sacrifice. He's a good strategic manager. I think he's a very good strategic manager, actually. But, you know, I thought there was some outside-the-box thinking with Miller. He used him not just in the Jay series, in the Red Sox series as well. He might bring him in the fifth with two men on because he wants to snuff out the rally, or he might wait until the eighth because that's when the big boys are coming up. He doesn't get boxed into this is how it's done. He doesn't think that way. And you know what? Joe Maddon, who's managing the Cubs, the series I'm doing right now, he doesn't think that way. Dave Roberts has done some very unusual stuff. He doesn't think that way. And I wonder if, you know, if the game is going to start to change a little bit where it's not so formatted, lefty against the lefty, setup man in the eighth, closer in the ninth. I think we're seeing managers do some things differently now.
In the interest of time, let's get to the Cubs and the Dodgers game 5 tonight. John Lester, Kenta Maeda. This looks like a big Cubs edge. Is there any reason for you to believe that it might not be?
Well, it seems like a significant edge. I mean, you know, the narrative of the series going forward would be Cubs win tonight, Dodgers win in the Kershaw game, game 6 Saturday, and I'm sitting at Wrigley Field for game 7 on Sunday night, lucky enough to do that game. But Lester was good in his last start, but Joe Maddon didn't think he was nearly as good as he's been through most of the year, and he hooked him a little bit quickly after 6 innings, and Lester wasn't real happy with that. But the Dodgers they're the worst hitting team in baseball this year against left-handed pitching. They have a ton of left-handed batters. Mm-hmm. They don't all play against the lefty. I think there are 3 righties in there tonight, but they've just got a lot of left-handed hitting, and they struggle. What they're going to try to do, John Lester cannot throw to bases, will not throw a pickoff throw, will not throw the ball to second base. Like if there's a runner at first and there's a ground ball back to him, he will not throw to second. And you're going to see the Dodgers try to mess with him both in a base stealing situation and maybe drop some bunts down and just see if he can throw the base.
Interesting.
It's that serious a case of the yips, and it's amazing. He might win the Cy Young Award this year. The guy can't throw the bases. Maeda, I think the Dodgers are nervous about. It's been a long season for him. He's never thrown this many innings, and the feeling is he might have hit a wall. His stuff's a little bit short right now. He's only averaging about 3 2/3 innings in his last 4 starts going back to the regular season. So, yeah, on paper, there's a sizable advantage for the Cubs tonight.
So if you get to 7, Hill goes for the Dodgers in that, and that's not all bad. It's pretty good. Mm-hmm. But it ain't Lester. Not Lester, Kershaw.
It would be Arrieta for the Cubs.
Yeah, it's not Kershaw. I mean, Hill's good, but he ain't Kershaw. So Kershaw goes in 6.
Yeah.
Is there a circumstance in game 6 under which you get Kershaw out a little early so that maybe you can get him to pitch an inning in 7?
I think it's possible, not if it's 6-0. I think it'd have to be like 10-0.
Well, it'd have to be a big number, right?
It would have to be a big number.
Okay.
I think it's possible. And I think they would resist the temptation to pitch him in 7 in any scenario. I mean, they pitched him in game 5 of the division series after he started game 4, but there was a travel day. There was a day's rest.
Well, I know. Yeah. In between. There's no rest here.
Right. I believe in 2001, and I Schilling and Johnson, I think it was Johnson who started 6. Schilling started 7, and then Johnson came in and pitched an inning in game 7 with no day's rest. I think it's possible. You know, when you get into the postseason, and we saw this with the Blue Jays, although it's heightened with other teams because, you know, the Blue Jays had a number of starting pitchers they can trust. You get down near the end, and the manager starts whittling down the guys he really trusts. And I think it's possible. You know, if he could get 6 out of Hill, you know, then does he go to Kershaw for 1 and then Jansen for 2? But, you know, we're a long way from that. I mean, they've got to split the next 2 games, and Kershaw can't throw 120 pitches in game 6 for that to happen. And Dave Roberts does believe in a couple of other guys. But I think if it was the difference, you know, Clayton Kershaw is a very headstrong, persuasive guy. I think he would go to Dave Roberts before game 7 and say, if you need me for 3 outs.
Yeah, I think so. 30 seconds. I need a quick answer to this. I've heard this story that there is a dramatic difference between the noise level at Wrigley and Chavez Ravine, that the Dodger fans are loud and the Cubs fans are almost sitting on their hands. Have you sensed that?
I don't think it's that bad, and I've heard that about Chicago, too. And you know, we're up in the rafters with headsets on, so sometimes,
granted,
even though I'm there, I'm not the best person to ask. I will tell you, the in-house, like the music and the drum beating and all that stuff at Dodger Stadium is off the charts loud, and that's not to be taken as a compliment. It's unbearable. but this Dodger crowd, you know, the perception is come late, leave early, wine and cheese. That's not this crowd. They are really, really good. I don't know that the release is quiet as it's been portrayed, but I think Dodger Stadium is loud. Nothing's been as loud as the Rogers Center for me this year.
No, I grant you.
Dodger Stadium's pretty close.
Danny, enjoy the game tonight, and a game 6 for sure, and maybe a 7. And we'll talk to you again next week, I hope.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Thanks, Dan. Dan Shulman, the voice of baseball on ESPN Radio, and of course here on Sportsnet. Richard Deitch of Sports Illustrated joins us. Hello, Deitch. How are you?
Well, first of all, the iconic Dan Shulman opening up for me. I feel like it should have been the reverse.
We tried to make that happen, but Dan's schedule was such that we couldn't. So, you get to follow him.
That was not intentional. Let me say this. This is you won't be expecting this, Bob. But
okay.
I spoke with Elliot Friedman today, who is kind enough to tape my podcast that I do for Sports Illustrated.
Oh, the one I haven't done yet? You haven't invited me to do?
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. The one I have not invited you yet. Your name came up multiple times in the podcast, probably, in fact, kind of too flattering, I would say, but generally speaking, all positive. But the one thing that stood out, and you will like this, Elliot Friedman said you gave him the best piece of professional advice he has ever received, as a broadcaster.
And yeah, I know the phrase. I remember, and we can't repeat it on air.
No, we cannot repeat it on the air, but you basically said, do not F with half. Meaning, if you're in a great position,
that's exactly what I said.
Don't necessarily change for a couple extra dollars, etc. And by the way, on the podcast, Elliot did use the curse word, which we will allow.
Gasp!
Less cursing on the podcast. So that was I like that. I'm going to steal that, by the way, and probably pass that on to some people here in the States. And I hope to give you credit for that. But if I don't, I may just steal it for myself. It's pretty good.
Well, go ahead. I have subscribed to that philosophy for many, many, many years. And Elliot came to me at one point when he had an option, a choice to make. And I said, how do you feel about where you are? And he said, I'm very happy with where I am. And I said, well, then don't mess with it. You know, there's in the long term. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, interrupt you. I was gonna say the one thing in all seriousness, Elliot was a terrific interview. We talked about how he approaches his job. A lot of talk about Hockey Night in Canada and those changes. But the one thing he really got into and got a little emotional, I didn't expect him to go this deep, was we talked about what happened in Rio and his calling of the Lochte Phelps race.
Oh, yeah.
Everything about that, from the mistake on the air to what he was like in the next 24 to 48 hours to who he heard from to the fact that he believes it would cost him not that he plans to leave anywhere, but he does not believe any American broadcaster would ever hire him after that. I disagree with him on that. He told me he had heard that. I'm not sure I buy that, but I'm not going to say he didn't hear it because obviously he did. It was really interesting. I mean, he's a quality broadcaster, and it was really interesting to get his perspective on, making a mistake nationally that he really takes, I think, far more personally than the average viewer who really respected him coming out right away and saying, I screwed up and I own it. So it was interesting. That was
Doesn't surprise me. I've known him. Yeah, I've known him since the beginning of his professional career, and that doesn't surprise me at all. He would take that. I knew when I heard about it. I didn't see the race, but I knew that he would take that probably harder than almost any other broadcaster I know. He wouldn't be able to slough that off.
He reflected that in the podcast. I mean, to the point where he was getting a little choked up as he was describing the aftermath. So, I appreciate his honesty, and two, I just found it really interesting because you don't often hear broadcasters talk about that.
So, basically, Deitch, you made Elliot cry. Is that basically what you're here to tell us?
I'd say, Damien, more than that, I've gotten a 6-minute promo for my podcast, which is genius.
Well done. Well done. Usually, McCown just says that, buy some time.
Exactly.
Well done.
So not only have I not appeared on your podcast, you apparently got Shannon and Amber to do some sort of a round table too that I didn't get invited to. It's just starting to piss me off, Deitch.
Yeah, you know, he says that, Richard, and yet you know if you invite him, he'll say, no, I'm not interested.
No, the first thing I'll say is how much, and then I'll say not interested.
Let me tell you something. Amber and Shannon could not have worked cheaper, as in zero.
That's the wrong number for me, pal.
Yeah, I appreciate that. They were part of a 9-person NHL media panel that I had where they talked about the biggest storylines of the year, best and worst organizations they deal with, player they most think who could walk into hockey broadcasting after he retired, most underreported story in the league. It was really good. Not only were David and John excellent, but everybody who was part of that panel, Greg Wyshynski and a lot of beat reporters across the U.S., really thoughtful answers, and that's what's one great thing about hockey is, and Damien knows this, you know, you do get access to players and organizations oftentimes more than in other sports, and I thought their insight was just really interesting.
You know what I find interesting is that since you've started doing this program and since you visited us here in the studio, your emphasis on Canadian broadcasters has been increased dramatically. Have you noticed that at all?
Yeah, I was going to say, I find, I told this to Elliot too, that it's just there's a more thoughtfulness and genteel quality when it comes to the sports broadcasting community in Canada. I think some of that.
Well, some of it.
Forget jokes aside, in all honesty, I think some of it has to do with, like when I do your program, the segments are longer. One can get into more of an in-depth conversation than we normally have in the States.
Right.
And I often think sometimes that, I hate to use this cliche, but there's just less of a hot take culture in Canada than there is in the States. And that is very good for me when I do like one of these roundtables where I get people to think about answers as opposed to just sort of going for one-liners to get attention. So there's no doubt. I'm sure I'm pandering a little bit to the Canadian
audience. A little bit, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you can't kill me for that as well. I feel like that's just good, good branding on my part.
We could do it, but you Americans have enough trouble with Clinton and Trump, so we're going to lay off for the time being.
My God. Yeah, I mean, there's never a day that goes by where you are not shaking your head at sort of stuff that happens in this country. You know, people say, it's only 20 days away, but, who knows? If Donald Trump may never not contest this election. I mean, he may sort of contest it in perpetuity.
But who cares,
or
though?
He ends up winning, and who knows what'll happen with the world. So it's people are going to wake up in America seriously on November 9th, no matter what side you lie on the aisle. And I'm not sure they're going to feel great, whoever wins. More like you're just going to sort of feel like exhausted.
Well, he might get no electoral votes, too. You know what I mean? He might get shut out.
What about, like, I mean, there's always a state, like, there are very heavy GOP states like Alaska and Mississippi. I mean,
I suppose you're right, like, but.
It's, you know what I mean? Very hard for the Republicans to win. In the same way, I can never see a Republican in modern day winning, like, New York or California, unless you're really, like, a centrist kind of candidate. I just think there's too many of those states where they would just never vote for a Democrat, regardless of who it was.
Well, but the California would vote for a Republican if he was a Californian. And they've done that before. They did that with Reagan.
That's true.
You know?
They did that with Reagan. And it's not inconceivable. Yeah, New York, you know,
if less so.
Like really like central, like Mike Bloomberg running as a Republican, maybe New York.
Yeah, maybe.
Go that way. But there's just certain states that New York, California, Massachusetts historically, that Vermont, that just.
They're Democratic states.
Republicans to win.
Yeah.
But listen, you know, I don't know what to believe anymore, Bob and Jamie. You know, I see in the last couple of weeks that people are predicting a blowout, but it's only 3 weeks ago where, if you looked at all these election polls, Donald Trump was sitting at 44, 45, and 46%. He was really creeping up.
Creeping is probably the right way to put it.
That's creepy.
It's interesting though, and Bob was talking about the election panel last night, and that is an area, and I'd be interested in your thoughts, in which sports television seems to have really influenced news television, where you have now gigantic panels of NFL Today. I don't know how many guys are on the panel now, and then you turn on CNN last night after the debate, and they've got 10 people on the panel. I go back in my memory and try to remember who did that first, but I'm pretty sure it was more a sports thing that now seems to have bled into the news organizations.
I totally agree with you. I'll tell you one thing which really sports has had an impact on the political coverage in the States is Pardon the Interruption was one of the first places, if not the first place, to sort of have a panel on the right side of the screen where you would sort of see, here are the upcoming topics for discussion.
Yeah.
And you now see so many political-oriented shows doing that, where they'll indicate to the audience kind of what they're going to debate. They debate it, and then they move on to another topic. That's totally stolen from sports. I agree with you. CNN is absurd. It's like a pundit on steroids. But the notion of having 5, 6, 7 people on a set, I think is totally stolen from NFL pregame shows, which, you know, in the 80s and 90s started loading up with analysts left and right. Both of you guys have done a lot of TV, Damian in particular. And the one thing that always blows me away, and I say this when it's a sports show or when it's a political show, is 9 or 10 people on a set could be the most unfriendly thing for viewers. It takes your eyes to places you don't want to go. It is hard to discern the voices on the set. It is as user unfriendly as it gets on television. Yet for whatever reason, producers seem to be obsessed by the moreness of it, by as many different voices and faces as you can have on. And for the life of me, I never understand it, because if you watch that CNN panel, a lot of times it is, forget about whether you agree or disagree with what they're saying, it's just simply unwatchable television.
Well, you know what? I watched last night's. It was the same jibber-jabber I watched after the second debate. Almost identical panel, same people, saying the same things. Republicans changing the topic because they couldn't defend the position. And everybody else was a Democrat and ripping the hell out of Trump. And it's just, Anderson Cooper is the moderator. He didn't say 5 words in an hour. He just let them go, you know?
Here's an interesting question is, will this goofy surrogate thing that they've come up with now, that basically they bring on people who will mindlessly say whatever the person will say, that Trump or Clinton would say. They just mindlessly, doesn't matter what they're confronted with, they just say it. I wonder if that would ever, and maybe, and some would argue, of course, that it has, if that would ever bleed over into sports broadcasting.
I think that has. I mean, if you know, here in the States, like Skip Bayless was very famous for just sort of defending or saying that Tim Tebow was great when he wasn't great, could lead teams to Super Bowls when that was impossible. So I think some of that has bled. But the surrogacy is incredible. I actually got some good traction last night on Twitter. Jeffrey Lord is sort of the main Trump surrogate.
He's bizarre.
defend bizarre. Whatever Trump says. So I had a good line saying that I thought at midnight Jeffrey Lord was going to argue why the Russians beat the U.S. in 1980, which where a lot of people actually enjoyed that. But that's essentially what it is. The guy, I'm not the person who came up with this, but we've sort of entered a post-truth society here a little bit in television in the States, where like the actual fact doesn't matter. It's sort of how you argue what we all know is not true, and I think you do see some of that in sports by the truly crazies who really don't care about facts. I think they care more about the performance art of screaming about whatever.
Oh, God, are you right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're a little tight on time, so we're going to let you wander off.
Fun discussion, though. That was interesting.
It was.
And he got his podcast.
Hope the audience stayed with us now.
Well, we wasted so much time advertising his podcast.
I know.
About Elliot.
Have you been on his podcast?
No.
Me neither.
No.
All right. Well,
we can all hope.
Thank you very much for putting me on.
We'll get the invoice. Richard Deitch of Sports Illustrated. He's a weekly guest here on the program. Speaking of that, Don Banks, NFL.com contributor. The Packers, the Bears, a titanic struggle, which may take place like the Titanic at the bottom of the ocean. When Primetime continues in a moment. Minutes before the hour, Primetime continues. McCown Cox in our Toronto studios here at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk. Here's our longtime NFL expert from NFL.com. Here's Don Banks. Hello, Banks. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Get over the Red Sox loss?
No, not completely.
No, okay.
But I'm not going to bemoan to you. You guys just lost your...
We're fresh. It's still a fresh wound for us. Thank you very much.
You ran into the wrong team, as we did.
Same team, same situation.
Yep.
Same result. It is very difficult for me to get motivated to watch the Packers and the Bears tonight because I'm not sure that both these teams won't wind up losing, such is the nature of these two football teams and the direction they're going at this moment in time. Can you explain the Packers more? I mean, the Bears are the Bears, and the expectations were significantly lower. But the Packers, with that Rodgers guy at quarterback, you always think they're going to be in the mix. Why have they been mediocre at best?
I wish I had a better answer. They've been an enigma to a lot of people, I think, for about a year now, roughly from about week 7 on last year when Rodgers' performance started to drop. It seems as if he is now back in the pocket, not believing that his receivers are going to be open. He anticipates trouble. Sometimes he anticipates the pass rush when it's not there. His mechanics have gotten sloppy. He's gotten where he plays with a playground style that we've all seen at times rescues them, but it has turned into a bad habit, and the receivers are not consistently winning their one-on-ones. The running game comes and goes. Eddie Lacy went on the IR today and reportedly has gained weight again. It has been a bunch of contributing factors, but by and large, it's almost as if the Mike McCarthy era, which has been wildly successful, has hit its shelf life in year 12. And that is not an unprecedented move for a coach in this league after a decade. But I cannot figure the Packers out for the life of me. They've played one half of decent football this season, and that was against Detroit in the first half.
Well, you have not been helpful at all then.
Sorry.
Okay.
Well, and for his part, Rodgers just puts it all down to accuracy. I've got to throw the ball more accurately.
No, that's more than
But
that.
Accuracy can be a product of many things, as all the things you were talking about, expecting coverages that aren't there, expecting pressure that isn't there. And it's interesting, isn't it, that at his level, at his age, with this much success, that all of a sudden his technique would get, as you said, sloppy.
He's in his prime. Yeah. I can't remember. I was trying to come up with, okay, Matt Schaub hit a wall there after a couple playoff seasons in Houston and lost it completely and became, you know, a bad backup quarterback. But Aaron Rodgers was elite. He was the best quarterback in the game, consensus. And he's struggling at a level now for about a year that makes no sense. It's not a short slump at this point. It is a, you know, he had highlights and the Hail Marys last year kind of rescued their season, but he has really lost his touch, and the accuracy rarely goes away to that extent, as we've seen it go away with him.
Well, the Packers will try and rediscover themselves, and the Bears will try and win their second game of the season tonight. That's what you have on the agenda this evening. You wanted to talk about a story that's very significant.
And very unpleasant, and that's the Josh Brown story that's been really going on. And I'm sure you'll have some insights for us. The Giants have said he is not going on their trip to London. Lots of stuff coming up saying what did they know, when did they know, disturbing new details. Maybe for those who aren't familiar with this story, you can bring us all up to date.
Well, the league and the Giants became aware of domestic violence arrest and said that they did their due diligence. The Giants actually re-signed him. The league suspended him one game, even though the new standard allows them to suspend him up to 6 games with the caveat that they can take circumstances under consideration and lessen that. Not only did they lessen it, they lessened it dramatically to 1 game. Well, now this is basically Ray Rice without the video. Paperwork became available, public records became available yesterday in the state of Washington that basically detailed that this was a long-running pattern of behavior, that Josh Brown, the kicker for the Giants, had acknowledged that he had abused his wife, acknowledged that he had a problem, that there had been multiple episodes. And in fact, that even the league went so far as having to move Josh Brown's wife, their child, and 2 children she had by a first marriage out of their hotel at the Pro Bowl a year ago when a drunken Josh Brown tried to gain entry, and they were already in separate rooms, they're getting a divorce, had to move her and the kids out of a room, thereby, I think, giving a red flashing signal to the league that this was a situation that had a lot of length and depth to it. And this is an almost unwinnable situation for the league once again. I think he's definitely gone. I don't think there's any doubt about it. He'll never kick for the Giants again. This is going to continue to gather steam. And the bottom line is, you know, after the league talked all that big talk about domestic violence and
they give him one game
program and how they weren't going to take it lightly, they did again in this case, and they failed to get the information they needed again in this case. And John Mara, the Giants owner, looks horrible. Roger Goodell, again, looks rather ineffective and powerless. And they need, once again, to understand that the woman has to get the jump ball at this point.
Well, and we saw this last year with Greg Hardy. The flaw in this seems to me is that they are allowing teams to make the decision rather than have a league policy. You thought the way they were embarrassed and then had to subsequently handle the Ray Rice situation might wake them up, but they seem to be saying, look, you guys decide whether you want, and if he's important enough to your team, well, then just do whatever you got to do. And they don't seem – it's very strange that they don't seem to be – cognizant of the way this is playing out in public.
I can't buy that they're not aware of it. They are. John Mara was quoted saying, you know, we knew about it. We were not clear to the extent of the abuse. that is almost an indefensible statement. Like, a little bit of abuse is okay, but this obviously went too far, and we didn't have all the information.
Wow.
One, you can't re-sign him if you don't have all the information. Two, if he wants to play in this league, make him produce that information and say that that's a stipulation of further employment. The league cannot continue to plead, we tried, we couldn't get the the authorities in the state of Washington to release. This supposedly was the big effort that the league was going to make sure it was never again beholden to just the legal system. It was going to do its own work, its own detective work, its own investigation. Clearly that has woefully fallen short yet again in this situation.
I don't know whether I'm right or wrong in my opinion on this, but I on one hand, I understand the reluctance of anybody to punish an individual for a crime in which society has not yet determined guilt or innocence. And yet, this really doesn't fit that mold, Banks. This is, there's an acknowledgement of misdoing, right? And when that's the case, why wouldn't you throw the book at him?
It's unfathomable, given the climate of 2014 after Ray Rice.
Yeah.
That's what makes absolutely no sense to go, when you put this, when you scream it from the housetops, we put in a new 6-game suspension for domestic violence, basically no, first time. No, there has to be some sort of fastball thrown, the league said. Well, then to come out and give him 1 game, that was puzzling. But basically what the Giants in the league said is, we feel comfortable, we investigated. They were intimating, it seemed, like there was more to the story than they could disclose, and that perhaps in this case, Molly Brown, who was his ex-wife and the victim, she wouldn't press charges, and therefore we were hamstrung by that reality. It doesn't hold up to scrutiny now that you know that there was this, basically this pattern of behavior, and that he had acknowledged it.
We got a minute. I want to touch on the Buffalo Bills because it's the team that's geographically closest to us here in Toronto, and there are a lot of Bills fans in this country. I'd a bet against them winning 4 in a row after losing their first 2. There was talk about all kinds of firings, including the head coach. If they continue down the path they were on, they have certainly turned it around. I don't think the Bills are a fluke, but they will play. Now, the good news is they play Miami, who stink, but they'll do it without LeSean McCoy. Is his absence enough to give the Dolphins a chance?
Yes, and this is a Dolphins team that just took the Steelers apart. So tell me which Dolphins.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that either. Yeah.
The one that lost to Tennessee at home by 13, 14 points, or the one that beat Pittsburgh by 15 points? The Dolphins are schizophrenic. Absolutely, Miami has a chance, especially without LeSean McCoy. He's been the LeSean McCoy of, say, 2012 to 2014 right now.
So the Bill, you aren't buying into the Bills just yet.
I am buying into them, but I'm saying the next 2 weeks is pretty telling because we could look up and they could be 4-4, having lost at Miami and then lost to Tom Brady and the Patriots in Week 8 in Buffalo, and everybody's going to say same old Bills.
Yeah, and it would be a familiar refrain that we know. Enjoy the game tonight, if that's even possible, and the weekend action. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you, guys.
Don Banks of NFL.com, our thanks to him, to Richard Deitch of Sports Illustrated, who still hasn't called to invite either of us on any of his little
things. Yeah, but I'm not interested. You apparently are.
Well, not at the price he's offering, which apparently is nothing. I don't know why anybody would do something for nothing. Mama needs new shoes. Got to find a way to get them. And our thanks to Dan Shulman of SportsNet and ESPN. Before that, Glenn Healy, Buck Martinez. And to you for contributing and participating and just watching and listening. See you tomorrow. Good night from Toronto.